A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about baby hygiene for one-year-olds with sensitive skin. The core tension is that the standard advice he's always heard is a daily bath, and that's what they've been doing. But he's now hearing that might actually be too much, and could be bad for skin. He's also asking about the fragrance-free dilemma. That's the default for sensitive skin products, but it becomes less practical when you need actual sanitation, like cleaning hands after contact with feces. Then there's the caregiver safety angle, which doesn't get talked about enough. How do you avoid getting sick from your own kid, especially if you're single parenting with no backup? And finally, he wants to know how long kids should actually spend in the bath, and what the key areas are that parents need to clean thoroughly.
There really is. And I want to start by saying the daily bath thing is one of those bits of parenting advice that somehow became universal without ever having much evidence behind it. The American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't actually recommend daily baths for infants or toddlers. Their guidance is that 3 baths a week are plenty for a baby's first year, and even for toddlers, you don't need to go beyond that unless there's a specific mess situation.
The standard advice he's been following is wrong.
It's not wrong in the sense that it's harmful in every case. Some kids tolerate it fine. But it's not evidence-based as a default. The AAP's position is that bathing too frequently can strip the natural oils from a baby's skin and worsen conditions like eczema. And one-year-olds have skin that's still thinner and more permeable than adult skin. Their skin barrier is still maturing.
Which means they lose moisture faster and absorb things more readily.
The stratum corneum, the outermost layer of the skin, doesn't fully mature until about age 2 or even later. So you've got a kid whose skin barrier is basically still under construction, and you're immersing them in warm water and whatever's in that water every single day. For a kid with sensitive skin, that's a recipe for dryness, irritation, maybe even triggering eczema flares.
3 times a week is the actual recommendation.
3 times a week is the baseline. The Mayo Clinic and the American Academy of Dermatology both back this up. Now, there are cultures where daily bathing is the norm and kids do fine. Japan comes to mind. But the water temperature tends to be lower, the baths are often shorter, and moisturizing immediately afterward is non-negotiable. It's not that daily bathing is universally catastrophic. It's that if you're already seeing skin issues, it's the first variable to adjust.
What about the days in between? You've got a one-year-old who's crawling, touching everything, getting food in their hair. 3 baths a week sounds like a recipe for a very grimy Wednesday.
That's where spot cleaning comes in. You don't need full immersion to handle the areas that actually get dirty. A warm washcloth on the face, hands, and diaper area. What some pediatricians call a top and tail clean handles most of the hygiene needs between baths. The key insight here is that not all dirt is equal. The grime on a kid's hands after lunch isn't the same as the bacterial load in the diaper area, and the approach should match the actual risk.
We're talking targeted hygiene rather than blanket immersion.
That's exactly the framework, and it's more aligned with how we think about adult hygiene anyway. You don't shower every time you get dirt on your hands, you wash your hands. The bath is for when the whole kid needs it.
Which brings us to the fragrance-free question. This is the part of the prompt I found genuinely tricky. Fragrance-free is the standard recommendation for sensitive skin. Every dermatologist says it. But then you're dealing with a diaper blowout and you want something that actually cleans.
Right, and there's a distinction here that a lot of people miss. Fragrance-free is not the same as unscented. Unscented products can still contain masking fragrances that neutralize the smell of other ingredients. Fragrance-free, properly labeled, means no fragrance. Compounds were added. And for sensitive skin, that's what you want. Fragrances are among the most common contact allergens, and they serve zero functional purpose in cleaning.
Does fragrance-free mean less effective at cleaning?
The cleaning power of a soap or wipe comes from surfactants, not fragrances. Surfactants are the compounds that lower the surface tension of water and help lift dirt and oils off the skin. They're completely unrelated to whether the product smells like a meadow or a chemistry lab. You can have a highly effective fragrance-free cleanser. Hospitals use them constantly. The problem is more psychological. We've been conditioned to associate clean smell with actual cleanliness and fragrance. Free products don't give you that sensory feedback.
The olfactory placebo effect.
It's especially strong with baby products, where the marketing has spent decades linking that powdery baby scent to the idea of a clean, cared-for infant. But that scent is just perfume. It's not doing anything for the baby's skin, and for kids with sensitivity, it's actively working against you.
What about the sanitation concern specifically? The prompt mentions feces. You've got a baby who's had a blowout. There's fecal matter on their hands, and you need to actually sanitize. Does fragrance-free soap handle that?
Here's where we need to separate cleaning from disinfection. Standard soap and water. Fragrance-free or not, doesn't kill bacteria. What it does is mechanically remove them from the skin's surface through the combination of surfactants and friction. When you're dealing with fecal matter, the primary goal is removal, not killing. Soap lifts the contaminants, water rinses them away. That's sufficient for routine diaper changes and hand washing after contact with feces.
What if you want actual disinfection?
For a one-year-old with sensitive skin, you almost never do. Hand sanitizers, alcohol-based ones, are effective against most pathogens in feces, but they're harsh on sensitive skin and they don't remove organic material. They kill in place, which is not what you want when there's actual visible contamination. For caregivers, after a particularly unpleasant diaper change, alcohol-based sanitizer makes sense as a second step after washing. For the baby, warm water and fragrance, free soap with good friction is the right approach.
What about wipes? The prompt mentions wipes specifically.
Wipes are an interesting case because they sit at this intersection of convenience and skin chemistry. Most conventional baby wipes contain preservatives, and many contain fragrances. The preservatives are actually necessary. You can't have a wet product sitting in a package for months without something to prevent microbial growth. But some preservatives, like methyl isothiazolinone, are known contact allergens. The American Academy of Dermatology has flagged this as a real concern, with increasing reports of allergic contact dermatitis linked to wipes, particularly around the diaper area.
What's the alternative for sensitive skin?
Water wipes are one option. They're essentially just water with a tiny amount of grapefruit seed extract as a preservative. They're more expensive, but they've got basically the shortest ingredient list in the category. Another option is to use dry wipes or soft cloths with plain water for routine changes and only use commercial wipes when you're out of the house or dealing with a mess where water alone won't cut it.
The prompt also raises the hand washing dilemma. You've got a one-year-old who's touched feces. You need to clean their hands properly, but you're trying to avoid harsh products. What's the protocol?
Warm running water and a fragrance-free liquid cleanser with the gentlest surfactant base you can find. Look for products that use desyl glucoside or cocoglucoside as the primary surfactant. Those are milder than sodium lauryl sulfate, which is in a lot of mainstream soaps and can be really stripping. And the technique matters as much as the product. 20 seconds of lathering with good friction, rinse thoroughly, pat dry rather than rubbing. Rubbing with a towel can cause microabrasions on already sensitive skin.
20 seconds with a one-year-old.
I know. You do what you can. The point is that friction and time are doing more of the work than the soap itself. Even if you only get 10 seconds of actual lathering, with good technique you're removing the vast majority of contaminants.
Let's talk about caregiver safety. The prompt raises this, and it's something I don't think gets enough attention. You're a single parent, or your partner's away, and you get norovirus from your kid. Now nobody's taking care of anybody.
This is an under-discussed aspect of parenting. Household transmission of gastrointestinal infections from young children to caregivers is extremely common. One study found that in households with a child under 2, the secondary attack rate for norovirus was over 50%. Half the caregivers got sick.
The mechanisms are not mysterious. You're handling feces directly. You're getting sneezed on. You're sharing surfaces. But the part that doesn't get talked about is that standard parenting advice often puts the child's comfort above the caregiver's safety in ways that are counterproductive.
That's the key insight. If you're the only adult in the house and you go down, the kid's care is compromised. So protecting yourself isn't selfish. It's part of providing consistent care. And the interventions are straightforward but underused. Gloves for diaper changes when the child has diarrhea. A dedicated hand towel that only you use. Diluted bleach solution for surfaces after a gastrointestinal illness. Not all the time, but during and after an active infection.
What about masks?
For respiratory illnesses, yes. For GI stuff, the primary route is fecal-oral, so hand hygiene and surface disinfection are your main defenses. But if the kid has a stomach bug and is also vomiting, droplet transmission becomes a factor, and a mask isn't unreasonable.
There's a psychological barrier here, too. Parents feel weird about treating their own kid like a biohazard.
And I think we need to normalize the idea that temporary infection control measures in the home are just good practice, not paranoia. It's the same logic as not sharing utensils with a kid who has strep throat. You can love your child and still not want their norovirus.
The prompt specifically mentions single parenting. What's different about the risk calculus there?
When you're single parenting, your margin for error is zero. If you're incapacitated for 24 hours, there's nobody to step in. So the threshold for protective measures should be lower. You wear the gloves. You use the separate towel. You're more aggressive about hand hygiene. And you stock the house with the supplies you'd need if you were sick and still had to function. Oral rehydration solution for yourself, not just the kid. Easy to prepare food. A plan for who you'd call if you couldn't get out of bed.
That last part is concrete and useful. Have a name. Have a number. Know who you'd call before you need to call them.
That applies even if you're not single parenting. If both parents go down simultaneously, which happens all the time with household infections, you're in the same situation. Having a pre-identified backup person is just good risk management.
Let's move to bath duration and key areas. How long should a one-year-old actually be in the bath?
5 to 10 minutes. The American Academy of Dermatology is pretty clear on this. Longer baths mean more water exposure, more transepidermal water loss, and more stripping of natural oils. For a kid with sensitive skin, shorter is better. And the water temperature should be lukewarm, around 37 to 38 degrees Celsius, roughly body temperature. If you're putting your elbow in and it feels warm, it's probably too hot. It should feel neutral.
Not the hot soap that adults tend to prefer.
Right, and that's a common mistake. Parents run the bath to a temperature that feels good to them, but adult comfort temperature is usually too hot for a one-year-old's skin. The test is to use your wrist or elbow, not your hand. Hands are less temperature sensitive. The water should feel neither warm nor cool.
What about the key areas? The prompt asks, what parents should make sure they clean thoroughly?
The neck folds. This is the number one overlooked area, especially in chubbier babies. Milk, drool, and food collect in the neck creases, and if they're not cleaned and dried properly, you get redness, irritation, sometimes fungal infections. After the neck, the diaper area is obvious but worth being specific about. For girls, always wipe front to back to avoid introducing fecal bacteria into the urinary tract. For boys, if uncircumcised, the foreskin should never be forcibly retracted at this age. Just clean what's visible.
What about behind the ears?
Also frequently missed. Milk and formula can run down behind the ears during feeding and get trapped in that crease. Same with the armpits and the folds of the thighs. Basically, any place where skin touches skin is a potential trap for moisture and debris. The rule of thumb is to check every crease.
Drying is as important as cleaning.
More important in some ways. Moisture left in skin folds is what creates the environment for irritation and fungal growth. After the bath, you want to pat dry thoroughly, not rub, and pay special attention to all those creases. Some pediatricians recommend letting the baby have a few minutes of naked time after the bath to air dry, completely before diapering.
That's also a good moment for moisturizer, I assume.
Yes, and the timing matters. The best time to apply moisturizer is within 3 minutes of getting out of the bath, while the skin is still slightly damp. That traps the water that's been absorbed into the skin during the bath. For sensitive skin, you want a fragrance-free emollient, something ointment-based rather than lotion-based, because ointments have fewer preservatives and create a better barrier. Plain petroleum jelly is actually one of the best options, and it's cheap.
The glockenspiel of pediatric dermatology.
I don't know what that means, but yes. It's inert, it's occlusive, it has a 0% allergic reaction rate. For a kid with really reactive skin, it's hard to beat.
What about bath products themselves? We've talked about fragrance-free, but what else should parents be looking for or avoiding in what actually goes in the water?
Bubble bath is the big one to avoid for sensitive skin. The surfactants that create bubbles are more aggressive. They have to be to create that foam, and they're a known irritant, especially for girls, because the bubbles can cause vulvovaginitis. The AAP specifically recommends against bubble baths for infants and toddlers. If you want something in the water, a small amount of fragrance, free bath oil could help counteract the drying effect of water, but you then have to be careful about the tub getting slippery.
Just warm water and maybe a little oil.
That's the safest baseline. And honestly, at 1 year old, the kid doesn't care about bubbles. That's for the parents.
Most of the baby product industry is for the parents.
I mean, yes. The baby doesn't care if the lotion has lavender and chamomile and is packaged in a soothing pastel tube. The baby cares about not being in pain from irritated skin. But the marketing is aimed at the purchaser, and it's incredibly effective at creating associations between those scents and the idea of good parenting.
There's a broader point here about the gap between what's marketed as gentle and what's actually gentle. The word gentle on a baby product has no regulatory meaning.
It's a marketing term. Same with natural, pure, sensitive. These are claims that don't require any specific formulation standard. A natural baby wash can be loaded with essential oils that are potent contact allergens. Tea tree oil and lavender oil, both commonly used in natural baby products, are known sensitizers. The European Union actually regulates some of this. They've restricted the concentration of certain fragrance allergens in leave-on products. The United States has much less oversight in this area.
Which means the burden is on the parent to read ingredient lists.
The ingredient lists are often long and written in chemical nomenclature that's hard to parse. My practical advice would be shorter ingredient list is generally better. Avoid anything with fragrance or parfum listed. And if a product is positioning itself as natural and is full of botanical extracts, be skeptical. Plants are chemically complex, and natural doesn't mean hypoallergenic.
Poison ivy is natural.
Natural is not a safety designation.
Let's circle back to the bath frequency question, because I think there's nuance we haven't covered. What about kids who get dirty every day? If your 1 year-old has spent the afternoon in a sandbox and then eaten spaghetti with their hands, 3 baths a week feels insufficient.
That's where you use judgment. The 3 times a week guideline is a baseline for a typical day. If your kid is visibly dirty, you bathe them. The guideline isn't saying never bathe more than 3 times a week. It's saying for routine hygiene, you don't need more than 3 times a week, and exceeding that regularly may cause skin issues. The distinction is between ritual bathing and need-based bathing.
The framework is bath when dirty, not bath because it's 7 p.m.
That's a much better heuristic. And when you do need to bathe more frequently, say you're in a phase where the kid is getting messy every day, you compensate by keeping the bath short, using minimal product, and moisturizing aggressively afterward. You can bathe daily if the circumstances demand it, but you have to offset the skin barrier disruption.
What about swimming? That's a related question I think a lot of parents have. Chlorinated pool water on sensitive skin.
Chlorine is definitely a potential irritant. The standard advice is to rinse off before swimming. Wet skin absorbs less chlorinated water, and then shower immediately after with a gentle cleanser to remove chlorine residue, and then moisturize. The pre-swim rinse is actually more important than most people realize. If the skin is already saturated with clean water, it takes up less pool water.
That's a good practical tip. I didn't know that.
It's one of those things that makes physiological sense once you think about it, but nobody tells you. Same logic as why you moisturize damp skin. The water is already there, and you're sealing it in rather than trying to add moisture to dry skin, which doesn't really work.
Let's go deeper on the caregiver safety piece. The prompt raises the question of not wanting to be made sick by your own child, and we talked about hygiene protocols. But what about the anticipatory stuff? What should a parent have in the house before anyone gets sick?
I'd say a basic caregiver sickness kit should include oral rehydration salts for adults, not just the kid version, disposable gloves, a box of nitrile gloves in the bathroom and near the changing area, a designated sick bowl or bucket that's only used for illness, disinfectant wipes that are actually rated for norovirus, not all of them are, bleach-based cleaners or hydrogen peroxide-based ones, because norovirus is resistant to a lot of standard cleaning products, including alcohol-based ones to some degree.
What about food? If you're the only adult and you're sick, you still need to feed the kid.
Have a stash of meals that require zero preparation, things you can open and serve at room temperature, pouches, crackers, whatever your kid will reliably eat. The goal is to reduce the number of decisions and actions required when you're barely functional. and have a plan for hydration for yourself. The biggest risk for a solo caregiver with a GI illness is dehydration. You can't take care of a one-year-old if you're dizzy and weak.
This feels like the kind of thing that should be standard prenatal advice and just isn't.
Prenatal education focuses heavily on the baby and very little on the caregiver's survival infrastructure. I think that's a gap, especially for single parents, but really for anyone. The question of what happens when you get sick should be part of the preparation, not something you figure out at 3 a.m. when you're vomiting and the baby's crying.
There's also the mental health dimension. Being the sole caregiver while sick is not just physically hard, it's isolating and demoralizing.
The sleep deprivation compounds everything. If you're sick and the kid's sick and nobody's sleeping, your cognitive function drops, your emotional regulation drops, and you're making decisions in a fog. That's when having pre-stock supplies and a pre-existing plan really matters. You're not trying to problem solve, you're just executing.
Let's shift to something the prompt asks about that we haven't addressed directly. The middle ground between fragrance-free everything and the need for actual sanitation. Is there a middle ground? Can you use a scented hand soap sometimes and fragrance-free wipes the rest of the time?
The middle ground is really about matching the product to the context. For leave-on products, lotions, creams, anything that stays on the skin, fragrance-free is non-negotiable for sensitive skin. The exposure is prolonged and the sensitization risk is higher. For rinse-off products, hand soaps, body washes, the exposure is shorter, so the risk is lower, but it's not zero. The compromise I'd suggest is keep everything that touches the face, the diaper area, and any eczema-prone zones strictly fragrance-free. For hand washing, if you're using a scented soap that gets rinsed off immediately, the risk is lower, but I'd still default to fragrance, free if the kid has demonstrated sensitivity.
What about for the parents' hand washing? If I'm washing my hands after a diaper change, I want them clean. And if I prefer a scented soap at my own sink, does that matter?
For the caregiver, use whatever soap gets you to wash your hands thoroughly and frequently. The best hand hygiene product is the one you'll actually use. If you hate the smell of your fragrance-free soap and you find yourself cutting corners on hand washing as a result, switch to something you like. The risk to the baby from trace fragrance transfer from your hands is negligible compared to the risk of you not washing properly after handling feces.
That's a sensible hierarchy. Function over purity.
I think that's the broader theme of this whole conversation. The goal isn't a perfectly optimized, zero-irritant environment. The goal is a kid whose skin isn't breaking down and a caregiver who isn't getting sick. Those are the outcomes that matter, and the protocols should serve them, not the other way around.
What about laundry? The prompt doesn't mention it, but it's adjacent. If you've got a kid with sensitive skin, does the detergent matter?
It does, and it's one of the more common sources of low-grade irritation that parents miss. Fragrance and laundry detergent is a major contact allergen, and it lingers on clothes, bedding, towels, everything the kid is in contact with for hours at a time. For sensitive skin, fragrance. Free detergent is a higher priority than fragrance. Free hand soap, because the exposure is continuous. And liquid detergents tend to rinse out more completely than powders.
What about fabric softener?
Avoid it entirely for sensitive skin. Fabric softeners work by depositing a layer of chemicals, usually quaternary ammonium compounds, onto the fabric. That layer is what makes clothes feel soft, but it's also sitting directly against the skin. And most fabric softeners are heavily fragranced. They're unnecessary and a common trigger for contact dermatitis.
The laundry protocol for sensitive skin is fragrance-free liquid detergent, no fabric softener, and an extra rinse cycle if your machine has that option.
That's the basic setup. And for new clothes, wash them before wearing. Clothing is often treated with formaldehyde resins and other finishing chemicals that can be irritating. That new clothes smell is not your friend.
Let's go back to bath duration for a moment. The prompt asks how long kids should spend in the bath. We said 5 to 10 minutes. But what actually happens if they stay in longer? What's the mechanism of harm?
The mechanism is transepidermal water loss. When skin is immersed in water, the stratum corneum absorbs water and swells. When you get out, that absorbed water evaporates rapidly, and it takes some of the skin's natural moisturizing factors with it. The longer the immersion, the more swelling, the more evaporative loss afterward. For a kid with an already compromised skin barrier, this can trigger a cycle of dryness and irritation.
The wrinkling is a signal that it's time to get out.
In a way, yes. By the time you're seeing pronounced wrinkling, the skin has been in the water long enough that you're past the point of diminishing returns. For a one-year-old, you'll often see it in the fingers and toes first.
What about the key areas for cleaning? You mentioned neck folds, behind ears, armpits, thigh creases. Are there any other spots parents consistently miss?
The belly button. At 1 year old, it's usually fully healed from the umbilical stump, but it's still a deep crevice that can collect lint, dead skin, and moisture. A quick gentle clean with a washcloth during bath time prevents irritation. Also, between the toes. Parents wash the feet but often forget to separate the toes and clean between them. If the kid is walking or cruising, feet can get surprisingly grimy.
For diaper area cleaning specifically, what does thorough actually mean? What's the technique?
For urine, a wipe with a damp cloth or a gentle wipe is sufficient. For feces, you want to remove all visible stool and then one more pass to be sure. The key is to clean all the creases, the junction between the thighs and the genitals, and for girls especially, the labial folds, always front to back. Then pat dry before applying any barrier cream. Putting barrier cream on damp skin traps moisture against the skin and can cause more irritation than not using cream at all.
The order is clean, dry, then protect.
That's the sequence. And if there's already a rash, you want to be even more meticulous about drying. Some parents use a hairdryer on the cool setting to make sure the area is completely dry before applying zinc oxide cream. It sounds excessive, but for a kid with persistent diaper rash, moisture control is often the missing piece.
A hairdryer on a baby. That's a mental image.
On cool from a distance. You're not roasting the child. But yes, it's one of those things that sounds bizarre until you've dealt with a diaper rash that won't heal, and then you'll try anything.
Let's talk about the transition period. The prompt is specifically about one-year-olds. What changes between the infant stage and the toddler stage in terms of hygiene needs?
At one, you're in a transitional zone. The kid is probably eating solid foods, which means messier faces and hands. They're mobile, crawling, or walking, which means more environmental exposure. They're touching floors, shoes, pets. The hygiene demands are increasing, but the skin is still immature, so you're in this awkward middle where the kid is getting dirtier but can't tolerate aggressive cleaning.
Which is exactly the tension the prompt is describing.
And the solution is to get more targeted rather than more aggressive. You're cleaning the hands more frequently, but not necessarily with harsher products. You're doing more spot cleaning between baths. You're paying more attention to the face after meals. The frequency of targeted cleaning goes up, but the intensity of each cleaning event shouldn't.
What about teeth? The prompt doesn't mention dental hygiene, but it's part of the overall picture at this age.
At 1 year old, you should have started brushing with a tiny smear of fluoride toothpaste, about the size of a grain of rice, twice a day. And you should have had a first dental visit by now. The American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry recommends the first visit by age 1 or within 6 months of the first tooth erupting. Dental hygiene is easy to overlook when you're focused on skin, but it's part of the same daily routine.
The bath is often when parents integrate toothbrushing, just because the kid is already in a hygiene context.
Which works fine. Just don't use the same washcloth for the face and the teeth.
I feel like that goes without saying.
You'd be surprised what sleep-deprived parents do at 8 p.m.
Let's talk about the fragrance-free product landscape. The prompt mentions that fragrance-free becomes less useful when basic sanitation is required. I think part of what's being asked is, are there products that bridge this gap, that are effective at cleaning, but still safe for sensitive skin?
The category to look at is what hospitals use. Hospital-grade cleansers are almost universally fragrance-free, and they're designed for frequent use on compromised skin. Products like Cetaphil Gentle Skin Cleanser and CeraVe Hydrating Cleanser use mild surfactant systems that clean effectively without stripping. They don't foam much, which can be psychologically unsatisfying, but the foam doesn't correlate with cleaning efficacy.
The foam is another sensory placebo.
Foam is created by surfactants that are good at trapping air, not necessarily good at cleaning. Sodium lauryl sulfate creates tons of foam and is quite harsh. Desal glucoside creates very little foam and is much gentler. But consumers associate foam with cleaning power, so manufacturers add foam boosters to gentle formulations just to meet that expectation.
Which means a parent trying to choose a gentle product might be misled by the lack of lather, thinking it's not working.
You have to retrain your brain to decouple foam from clean. It's like decoupling the baby powder scent from the idea of a clean baby. The marketing has done decades of work to create these associations, and you're fighting against it in the bathroom at bath time.
What about the cost question? The prompt doesn't raise it directly, but specialized fragrance. Free products tend to be more expensive. Is the price difference justified, or are there affordable options that work just as well?
There are absolutely affordable options. Store brand fragrance free baby washes are often formulated very similarly to the premium brands. The ingredient lists are nearly identical in many cases. Petroleum jelly as a moisturizer is about as cheap as it gets. Plain water on a soft cloth for routine diaper changes costs nothing. The expensive part tends to be the trial and error, buying products that don't work and having to replace them. So my advice would be to start with the simplest, cheapest option first. Fragrance-free drugstore cleanser, petroleum jelly, water wipes, and only escalate if those don't work.
Start minimal and add only what you need.
Which is good advice for most things in parenting, honestly.
Let's address the single parent angle one more time, because I think there's a psychological piece we haven't touched. The prompt mentions not having a backup. That's not just a logistical problem, it's a constant background stress. Every sniffle from the kid is a potential crisis.
That stress has physiological effects. Chronic stress impairs immune function, which makes you more likely to get sick from the same exposure. It's a vicious cycle. So part of the caregiver safety protocol is acknowledging that stress and building the infrastructure to reduce it. Having the sick kit we talked about. Having the phone number of someone who can help. Having a plan. The plan itself reduces stress even if you never use it, because your brain can stop running the what-if simulation.
The plan as psychological prophylaxis.
That's a very corn way to put it, but yes. The plan is partly for the emergency, and partly so you can stop worrying about the emergency.
What about the flip side of all this? Are there risks of being too hygienic? The hygiene hypothesis gets thrown around a lot.
The hygiene hypothesis has been refined significantly since it was first proposed. The current understanding isn't that we're too clean, in a general sense. It's that early exposure to specific commensal microorganisms helps train the immune system, and modern sanitation has reduced that exposure. But the microorganisms that matter for immune development are mostly not the ones you're removing with bath time and hand washing. You're not harming your kid's immune system by cleaning feces off their hands.
The hygiene hypothesis is not a reason to skip the hand washing.
The hygiene hypothesis is about exposure to harmless environmental microbes, not about exposure to fecal pathogens. There's no immune benefit to getting norovirus. The confusion comes from people conflating cleanliness, in the sense of removing dirt and sterility, in the sense of eliminating all microbial exposure. They're not the same thing, and the evidence doesn't support reducing basic hygiene.
That's a helpful distinction. The prompt's tension between cleanliness and skin health is real. But the solution isn't to abandon cleanliness, it's to be smarter about how you achieve it.
That's the thesis of this whole conversation. The goal is clean enough without crossing into overcleaned, and for a one-year-old with sensitive skin, that line is closer than most parents realize.
Any final thoughts on the key areas question? We've covered the neck, behind ears, armpits, thigh creases, belly button, between toes. What's the one thing you'd tell a new parent to never skip?
Dry the neck folds. If you do nothing else, dry the neck folds. The number of babies I've seen with angry red creases under their chins because moisture got trapped there is staggering. It's such a simple thing, and it prevents so much discomfort.
Dry the neck folds. The four-word parenting mantra.
Put it on a t-shirt.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1912, a New Zealand farmer on the South Island discovered that if you measured the wool output of his entire flock in imperial stone per season and converted it to the old French quintal system, the numbers matched almost exactly the population of Christchurch at the time. Leading a local newspaper to briefly claim the city's growth was divinely calibrated to the ovine cycle.
I have so many questions about the ovine cycle.
I have so many questions about why anyone was converting wool to French quintals in 1912 New Zealand. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtoff, for making this show possible. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We're at myweirdprompts.com for past episodes and transcripts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird promise, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.